from the classroom to the emergency room, OR and beyond. You're joining Trauma ICU Rounds with your host, Dr. Dennis Kim.
I want to thank everyone for having me join you for Grand Rounds. Special thanks to Dr. Dara DeMaisy for the invitation. Obviously, we work so closely together, and it's always a pleasure to be able to talk with you guys about a topic that's near and dear to my heart, resuscitative thoracotomy, who, when, and how. And on top of that, I thought it would be nice if we could talk a little bit about emergent airways as well, not so much from the standpoint of, you know, LMAs and bougies, really more from a surgical or technical standpoint, some stuff on crikes. So I have no financial disclosures, and the following presentation does contain some graphic images that I think everyone in the audience is very much used to working here. So by the end of this presentation, you should be able to, number one, describe the indications for and contraindications to performing a surgical cricothyroidotomy, as well as resuscitative thoracotomy. Number two, understand the key steps in performing a crike as well as thoracotomy. And number three, we're going to go over some key damage control techniques as it relates to thoracic trauma. Now, I think in January, I'll be giving you another talk. And for today's talk, I think we're really going to focus more on the ABCs. And in the upcoming talk, I'd like to go over some of the more recent literature when it comes to damage control resuscitation, a plasma and whole blood first resuscitation strategy, and then go over some basics in terms of viscoelastic assays, or TEG, which everyone is well aware is widely available now, and we're doing pretty much routinely, especially on these sick trauma patients. And I'd also like to throw in a little bit about TEE, which I personally don't do. I know several of you do, but trying to find the role for that in the acute resuscitation of bleeding patients. So to start off with a case presentation, this is an 18-year-old male who comes in with multiple gunshot wounds times five, to the left chest, back, left arm. On arrival, his BP is 150 over 135, GCS is 3, and he's being bag valve masked with SATs of 90%. So a couple of questions. What are our priorities, and should we perform a resuscitative thoracotomy? And given that picture and the fact that this talk is on thoracotomies, you can imagine the answer to that is yes. Now, one thing I do want to point out with that blood pressure, for the novice, they're going to look at that blood pressure and think, oh, wow, 150 over 135, this patient's hemodynamically stable. Again, I want you to really pay attention to two things about that blood pressure. One is the elevated diastolic, which is always concerning. And number two is the narrowed pulse pressure. So it's very frequently seen, and we published a paper on this just last year in the American Journal of Surgery, looking at the narrowed pulse pressure and the need for either number one, a massive transfusion protocol activation, or number two, some sort of therapeutic intervention, whether that was a thoracotomy, laparotomy, or angioembolization. So that blood pressure there is always very concerning. If you cycle the sphygmomanometer, almost certainly the next blood pressure, you'll have a systolic of 60. And in fact, in this patient, right after that blood pressure was taken, we couldn't palpate a pulse. And so we have pretty much every indication here to perform a resuscitative thoracotomy. And, you know, when I was in training as a fellow, we were always told that you have to secure the airway first, meaning put down an ET tube prior to performing the thoracotomy, but there is more and more data suggesting that we can probably defer that, similar to how we do a CAB approach for ACLS, and move right on to hemorrhage control, relieving tamponade, bag valve mask the patient, and provided they have a patent airway and you're able to oxygenate and ventilate, secure the airway afterwards. And that's, in fact, what we did in this patient, but more on that a bit later. So when it comes to who, when, and how, this is a study from 2000. It's hard to believe it's 20 years ago that Peter republished together from the American College of Surgeons Committee on Trauma. And they had a few indications in terms of when we should be performing a thoracotomy. And the big take home from this paper is that there's a few factors we want to bear in mind when we're trying to think about a viability. Is this a high viability situation or a low viability situation? And the things that go into that decision making are, number one, mechanism of injury. So penetrating patients in general are going to do a lot better than blunt. And overall survival in patients with penetrating trauma, whether that's a stab wound or gunshot wound, with stab wounds being portending a better prognosis than gunshot wounds, survival is about 8% versus blunt trauma, where the survival rate is less than 1%. So we want to think about mechanism. We also want to think about location of injury. So patients who have injuries isolated to the thoracic cavity or chest are definitely going to do better than patients with, let's say, a torn iliac vein, which are going to do better than patients with multi-cavitary injuries. The other thing to bear in mind is signs of life. And by signs of life, that's not vital signs. Signs of life, we're really talking about a few things: pupillary reactivity, electrical activity on the monitor, agonal respirations. And so when patients have a penetrating mechanism with an isolated chest injury and signs of life, well, those patients are going to do the best. And so when you think about a patient who comes in with a stab wound to the precordium or chest with cardiac tamponade, survival in that patient population is about 30%. And those are always really great cases to do. We've done many, many of those together over the years. And oftentimes those patients do really well, provided that they haven't actually exsanguinated into their left hemithorax. This is an algorithm from the Western Trauma Association, WTA. And again, here you can see that the big things we're looking for are patients who are in refractory shock. So we don't have to wait until patients are dead to perform a resuscitative thoracotomy. In fact, any patient with signs of life or a systolic blood pressure less than 60, or let's say a very weak, almost non-palpable radial pulse, those are candidates for a resuscitative thoracotomy. And the thing here we want to do as soon as we get into the chest, and we'll show you some pictures afterwards, is take a look at the pericardium and is there blood in there? If there is, open it up, remove the clot, occlude the hole, fix it, and then move on from there. But if there's no blood in the pericardium, the whole purpose of doing this thoracotomy is to maintain cardiocerebral circulation. And so that means identifying the descending thoracic aorta, incising the mediastinal pleura, delivering it, and then putting a cross clamp on. And the whole purpose here is to perfuse the brain as well as the coronaries. The Eastern Association for the Surgery of Trauma a few years back also released this evidence-based approach to determining who should undergo, they call it an ED thoracotomy. I think the proper terminology is probably more resuscitative thoracotomy. And again, here, similar to that original paper from 2000, patients with signs of life after penetrating thoracic injury, these are the patients that they strongly recommend just jumping to resuscitative thoracotomy. Every other condition, especially if it's blunt or without signs of life, is really physician judgment or discretion. The only issue with that is, you know, so oftentimes when we get that handoff from our paramedics, you know, they always just lost their vital signs as they're getting off the ambulance, or just lost their vital signs as they were being wheeled into the ED. And so sometimes that makes the decision making a little bit more difficult. But we do look at things like signs of life, age, mechanism. And the other thing that's been very helpful is just to actually throw the ultrasound probe on and see if there's any cardiac activity. In the absence of cardiac motion with the FAST, the likelihood of survival is pretty much zero. And again, this is our prime directive. We want to maintain cardiocerebral circulation. And in terms of the physiologic rationale, so these are the key steps that we want to do. Number one, like I talked about, release tamponade. Number two, control cardiac hemorrhage. We're going to occlude the descending thoracic aorta. If necessary, open cardiac massage together with defibrillation using the internal paddles and or intracardiac epi, particularly if they have no spontaneous circulation. And then we want to control intrathoracic hemorrhage. And on the occasional patient, they may be at risk for a massive air embolism, particularly if they have an injury to the pulmonary hilum. So in terms of the key steps here, similar to when we perform a crike, you want to plan, prepare, and perform. And so when you open up the tray, this is what it looks like. You can imagine it's very difficult to figure out what you need. So when we look at our pager, we have to make a determination right there, like how bad is this patient and do we think we're going to have to open their chest? And if there's any inkling that we're going to have to perform a thoracotomy, I like to open the tray and simplify it. And these are literally all the instruments that you need. And so you have your knife, a pair of scissors, your rib spreaders or finchetto retractor, tooth forceps to grab the pericardium, and then your choice of an aortic clamp, either a DeBakey or Crawford clamp or a Satinsky side-biting clamp. The other thing that's always helpful to have is a 2-0 proline. Again, if someone does have a stab wound or gunshot wounds are certainly a little bit more difficult to sew up, but you can always throw a stitch to get temporary hemostasis, and a stapler works really well. Occasionally, we do have to do a clamshell thoracotomy, and so that's when we extend the thoracotomy over to the right side, so it's essentially a bilateral antrolateral resuscitative thoracotomy. So if we think that they've got right-sided injuries, particularly life-threatening bleeding, then we're going to want to extend. So key steps, we've already talked about these, so let's go through these one by one. Again, in terms of access and incision, we want to make a curvilinear incision from below the nipple, starting at the sternum towards the axilla. Some people will actually start the incision to the right of the sternum, so that if you do need to come across the sternum, your incision's already made to do that. Again, depending on the anatomy and body habitus, the chest wall can be quite thick, but with those swipes of the knife, you want to get through the skin sub-Q muscle down to the rib cage, at which point you're going to put in your finchetto retractor and open and expose the intrathoracic contents. And here's a view of a flat, empty heart with a cross clamp on. Again, the retractor, how we place it does make a difference. Some people like to always make sure that the rack here is on the bed. The whole point being, if you do need to extend into a clamshell, this isn't getting in your way. And the other thing to really help with your exposure is to make sure that all this chest wall musculature is divided. When we open up the pericardium, the key thing here is to avoid the phrenic nerve. And that's usually located in a pretty posterior location. So here's a sample way back there. And so you don't need to be back there. You should be opening up the pericardium here. You're looking at this particular pericardium. There's no blood in there. So really delivering it probably isn't going to help you too much. Although when you're performing intracorporeal CPR, it may be beneficial. And again, here's a gunshot wound to the heart, completely flaccid, empty heart, and partially incised sternum. Here's a stab wound to the left ventricle. Again, you can see that it's already stopped bleeding. We have a little lap pad behind the heart. I think you guys are well aware that when we're doing these either through a sternotomy or through a thoracotomy, we want to be careful when we lift up the heart. Occasionally, if patients are really tachycardic and you've got unsteady hand or nervous resident, will sometimes ask you guys to push some meds to help slow down the heart. And that sometimes can be helpful. Things like adenosine, for example. And here's a picture of internal paddles. It's always great when we can get a patient from a PEA or asystole into a shockable rhythm. That's what we always want to see, that progress to return spontaneous circulation. When we cross clamp the aorta, sometimes I think you'll notice either in the ER or sometimes even in the OR, it takes a little bit of time to do this. And the big thing here is if there's already a large hemothorax, we've got to kind of evacuate all that blood so that we can actually identify the aorta, which oftentimes is very flat. When we're trying to do this, sometimes we might ask you to kind of hold ventilation just so the lung's not billowing out into our face. And the key point here is we need to incise the mediastinal pleura and then pull the aorta out, because if you don't do that, you can't actually get the cross clamp on. The mediastinal pleura prevents that. And then, of course, we have the goose or esophagus just anterior to the aorta. I think for inexperienced folks, it may sometimes help to have an NG tube down to feel it. And once you've done enough of these, that's unnecessary. Here's a great picture of a patient who's been resuscitated. Their aorta is now big and juicy, and you can see that mediastinal pleura incised. And there's an intraoperative video of that. So that's a successful case there. And again, like I said, there's, you know, in some patients, particularly if they have a major vascular injury, there's going to be just a lake or a pool of blood. And so getting that evacuated certainly helps with visualization. But so much of this is feel. This is an unfortunate patient who actually had a ruptured or blunt thoracic aortic injury. And you can see this part of the aorta should be sitting here. And so about as bad as it gets. Here's an example of what a mediastinal hematoma looks like. This is a different patient with a thoracic injury. And you can see that the mediastinal pleura here is just bulging with hematoma and clot from that injured aorta. And again, this is what we want to see, return of spontaneous circulation. And then, of course, we need to wean that clamp off. Hopefully, we're communicating with you guys above the blood-brain barrier, not just to figure out where we are in terms of our base deficit, as well as hemocues, but to sort of explain when we're going to be taking the clamp off so that you guys can be prepared for the washout and reperfusion injury. In terms of when to clamshell, I'm not going to spend too much time on that. We've already talked about why we're going to do that. Oftentimes, you'll see in the ER, we'll have the ER folks put in a right-sided chest tube while we're doing a thoracotomy just to see if there's anything in there. You don't even need to do a chest tube. These days, you just do what's called a finger tube thoracostomy. Literally stab the chest wall, stick your finger in the pleura, see if there's any rush of air suggestive of a tension pneumo or blood in there. And we can also do that from the left side. In fact, I routinely will pass my hand anterior to the mediastinum and open up the right pleura and look to see if there's blood in there. And the exposure with this clamshell thoracotomy, it's really, there's nothing that can compare to this exposure for the intrathoracic contents. Now, in our particular patient, so we held off on intubating him. We sort of did this CAB approach, started our whole blood resuscitation, cross-clamped his aorta, actually got return of spontaneous circulation, at which point we knew we were going to head up to the OR. He had multiple pulmonary as well as chest wall bleeding injuries. But before that, we wanted to, of course, secure his airway. And so there were multiple attempts, about three attempts per the EM. And that was by the resident and attending, and then one or two attempts per anesthesia. And at this point, the patient's SATs really started to plummet. And so I guess the question here becomes, are there any other adjuncts of value here? With those attempts, it was a combination of both DL as well as video laryngoscopy, and the patient had a very anterior airway. And so although they were able to almost sort of pass the tube through the cords, it just failed. And then, of course, should we crike or not? Well, with the SATs plummeting, at that point, we made the decision to cut the patient's neck. And again, plan, prepare, perform. I think everything goes into planning and preparation. And you want to make this as simple as possible. You know, the many, many crikes we've done over the years with you guys, I think the thing to bear in mind is you need three pieces of equipment. Nothing more, nothing less. You need a well-educated finger. You want a blade or a knife, typically an 11 blade. That's my preferred approach because of it's pointy, it's long, and it's got a long surface area that's sharp. And so it's great for kind of stabbing and sawing. And then some airway device, whether it's an ET tube or a tracheostomy, it doesn't matter. Personally, I like tracheostomies. They're nice and rigid. They're short. You're not going to mainstem them. But very rarely will we have one available at the time of an emergent airway. And most of these patients are peri-arrest. You know, they're getting CPR. They're difficult to bag. And so you just want to use what's on hand. The key point to remember here is you need a smaller tube than you would use. So in most adult males, I'd ask for a 6-0 ET tube. Even a 4-0 will suffice in this particular situation. And when we're going to do this, you know, as a fellow in San Diego, They had a very aggressive policy for performing these crikes. And anytime a patient was intubated, the attending surgeon or fellow would always stand on the right side of the patient. And they were the ones that performed cricoid pressure. The whole idea being you get a sense of the anatomy. You can already feel where the cricothyroid membrane is. And then you're already positioned to do a crike versus standing at the foot of the bed. Now, whether you're on the left or right, I think a lot of that has to do with your dominant hand. So if you're right-handed, you want to stand on the right side of the patient. If you're left-handed, you want to stand on the left side of the patient to perform this procedure. And, you know, we did a couple of these in just the last 2 weeks alone. And when it comes to doing this, a question that always comes up is, should I make a vertical versus a transverse incision? And in this particular picture here, this gentleman was a patient who had a known history of previous tracheostomy, and so had a big scar there. You can see that has a larger body habitus. And so it was very difficult to feel this patient's cricothyroid membrane. The anatomy was distorted. And so in those particular situations, I would always use an extensile incision. And this is not the time to be minimally invasive or make little keyhole incisions. I'd make a large slash right over the anterior neck, over the airway, vertically. And once you've gone through the skin and sub-Q, the anatomy then becomes very easy to identify because all you're left with is the airway. And so at that point, you can feel the tracheal cartilage, you can feel the cricoid cartilage, and then in between those two is going to be the cricothyroid membrane, which you are going to incise transversely. Now, a couple of key points. You want to make sure that the tube is well secured. And so that's always the case, of course, whether you're intubating from above or below. And so typically we'll take an O-silk, take a huge bite and then secure it and then have someone physically hold that tube as you get up to the OR to obtain hemostasis. And then the decision to formalize to a trach really needs to be individualized. And so again, I think in the past it was sort of this unstated law or rule that if a patient has a crike, it needs to be formalized to a trach. There's a couple of studies out there from USC as well as Parkland that have shown that, in fact, you don't need to convert these. And the risk for things like subglottic stenosis, even with short to long-term follow-up, really is no different between the two groups. Here's another crike that was performed. So again, in this patient, you can see this was a transverse incision. In this particular patient, it was easy to palpate the cricothyroid membrane. So as opposed to making two incisions, one vertical and then another transverse, you just make one incision directly through the skin, through the cricothyroid membrane, and then put your tube in. And you can see we've replaced the ET tube with an armored tube. Love these because you're able to bend them, move them out of the way so you can obtain hemostasis. One thing you need to always bear in mind, I think, especially in the trauma bay, everyone's really amped up. The catecholamines are surging and flowing. But I have done this before. You got to be careful not to just right main stem them. The issue there is they drop their left lung. They start to become hypoxemic, their sats start dropping, we start freaking out that maybe the tube's been dislodged. So again, you don't need to go too deep with these because again, the distance to the crina is much shorter than when you're intubating from above or orally, transorally. And you wanna listen for good breath sounds, make sure you have end-tidal CO2 to confirm that you're in the airway. Just really quickly, we're going to go over a couple of hemorrhage and damage control techniques. This is stuff that you see us doing all the time. I already mentioned the use of staplers for patients with simple lacerations of the myocardium. Great temporary way of getting hemostasis. Foley catheters, we do this occasionally. To be honest with you, I've kind of moved away from doing this. I think, you know, it can cause more harm than good. You also lose a lot of cardiac volume, I think, when you do this technique, especially if you've got a big blown up balloon. And so, you know, I'd rather just keep my thumb or finger on the injury until we can get some sutures into it. Satinsky or side biting clamps also work quite well, especially on the thin-sided RV. And here's a picture of a complex gunshot wound that required multiple sutures and pledgets to fix. Here's a much simpler one. And another. Here's a gunshot wound that just skived through the apex of the heart that we ended up oversewing as well. In terms of thoracic or pulmonary damage control techniques, staplers and tractotomies are really the way to go. This is not the time to be doing any sort of formal resection. If patients have a potential hilar injury, that's when we want to get a Sitinsky around it, first starting with manual occlusion between our fingers using our hand. And occasionally we can get a TA stapler in there. We don't have to fire it, but you can just kind of crunch it down so that it prevents bleeding from the hilum and may also decrease the risk for a massive air embolism. Here's an example of a right pneumonectomy here. You can see the diaphragm bulging chest tube and the entire lung's been removed. As you can imagine, these patients are going to have major issues with RV afterload, and many of them will just go into acute right heart failure. So some of the things that have been proposed to prevent that or at least help offset that is ECMO, either VV or VA, and then use of intraoperative nitric oxide to decrease the pulmonary vascular resistance. Occasionally, we'll do this lung twist maneuver. Unfortunately, in the patient that we're talking about, he actually had his lung infarcted due to twisting of the lung, which was not done on intention. Here's a paper from Dr. Vannata and our chief Putnam from a few years back looking at hilar control and penetrating chest trauma, a two-handed technique. And then in terms of vascular damage control, here's a picture of a transected aorta. You can see that there was a reboa in and we've shunted it, attempted to repair it. The patient succumbed. And here's an example of a left subclavian artery that we can see through the actual resuscitative thoracotomy incision. And damage control, I think we do this quite a bit. So when patients are hypothermic, acidotic, coagulopathic, we want to get in, stop the bleeding, put on temporary dressings, and get up to the ICU to get warmed. And then the only other thing I'll say is that, you know, this procedure is certainly not without risk. And so we were part of this prospective multicenter study looking at occupational exposure and found that about 1 in 10 healthcare providers who are involved in the thoracotomies actually get some form of exposure defined as a needle stick, cut with a sharp object, contact with mucous membranes or non-intact skin with blood, saliva, tissue, or other bodily fluids. So earlier when I mentioned, you know, high versus low viability, I think this is something to bear in mind. We want to protect ourselves as well. And there's a picture of our crew. And for those of you who don't know, I do have a podcast called Trauma ICU Rounds. You can follow me on Twitter at Trauma ICU Rounds. And I'd certainly appreciate it if you take a listen. And if you like it, leave some positive feedback on iTunes or Spotify. So with that, I think I will leave it there. And I am more than happy to answer any questions that you might have.